13. Eating people is bad. Baby, baby, naughty baby, hush you squalling thing, I say. Peace this moment, peace, or maybe Bonaparte will pass this way. And he'll beat you, beat you, beat you, and he'll beat you all to pap, and he'll eat you, eat you, eat you, every morsel, snap, snap, snap. The Oxford Dictionary of Nursery Rhymes. The word taboo has a Polynesian origin, and the English explorer and navigator Captain James Cook reported that its use by the South Sea Islanders related to the prohibition of an array of behaviors, from eating certain foods to coming into physical contact with tribal leaders. Unfortunately for Cook, the first official link between the terms taboo and cannibalism may have been based on his crew's initial, though evidently mistaken, fear that Cook himself had been cannibalized. On February 14, 1779, after what turned out to be a serious misunderstanding, Cook was clubbed to death by Hawaiian islanders, who then cooked and deboned his body before divvying it up among local chiefs as a way of incorporating him into their aristocracy. Since it was only right that Cook's own people got their share of the body, a charred section of it was returned to Lieutenant James King, who asked the Hawaiians if they had eaten the rest of it. According to King, "They immediately showed as much horror at the idea as any European would have done, and asked, very naturally, if that was the custom among us." So while the islanders had murdered, cooked, and filleted the explorer, they hadn't eaten him, though the latter point is often misrepresented in accounts of the incident. Ray Tannehill, a British historian who wrote both fiction and nonfiction, was perhaps best known for her books Food in History and Sex in History. In 1975, she wrote Flesh and Blood, the first scholarly study of cannibalism accessible to the general public. In it, Tannehill proposed that Judeo-Christian customs related to the treatment of the dead contributed to the strongly held belief that eating people was wrong. Specifically, she referred to the belief that a man needed his body after death so that his soul might be reunited with it on Judgment Day. Since cannibalism involved dismemberment as well as other procedures familiar to those in the butchery profession, it was no surprise that these practices induced in Christians and Jews alike an unprecedented and almost pathological horror of cannibalism. Decades later, others, like journalist and author Maggie Kilgore, addressed questions related to the prevalence of cannibalism taboos. They suggested that in addition to wanting the bodies of the dead to stick around intact until Judgment Day, our picky rituals concerning what foods could or couldn't be eaten, such as the Jewish ban on eating pork, were just as important. To Kilgore, the term, "you are what you eat," is a reflection of the importance of food as a symbolic system used to define personal, national, and even sexual differences. Outsiders and foreigners, according to Kilgore, are often defined in terms of how and especially what they eat and denounced on the grounds that they either have disgusting table manners or eat disgusting things. For example, the derogatory term frogs for French people is based on their consumption of frog's legs, something the British, who coined the term, would presumably never do. Likewise, and once again echoing anthropologist Bill Ahrens's stance, calling someone a cannibal becomes a means of using dietary practices, whether real or imagined, to define a particular culture as savage or primitive. Of course, this idea leads to the question of whether cannibalism might be more frequent or more readily acceptable in cultures that don't hold Judeo-Christian beliefs about the afterlife, or whose adherents follow diets with fewer religious or culturally imposed restrictions. First, though, let's investigate how the Western cannibalism taboo became so widespread, a phenomenon that began with an ancient civilization whose early writings would go on to influence both Christian and Semitic cultures. In all likelihood, the first mention of something approaching cannibalism in Western literature occurs in Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey, which dates from approximately the 8th century BCE. On an island stopover, the adventurer Odysseus, known as Ulysses in Latin, and his men enter the cave of Polyphemus, a cyclops, albeit one with a human shape. Luckily, the giant is out tending his flock, so the Greeks make themselves at home, lighting a fire, eating some of the big guy's cheese, and trying to decide what else they can steal. The party ends abruptly when Polyphemus returns home and blocks their exit with an enormous stone. Odysseus tries to bluff his way out, bragging about the city he had recently sacked and presumably his soon-to-be-famous wooden horse trick. He also tells Polyphemus to be extremely careful, since he and his pals are well protected by the gods. The Cyclops, however, appears somewhat less than impressed. According to Odysseus, "Lurching up, he lunged out with his hands towards my men, and snatching two at once, wrapping them on the ground, he knocked them dead like pups. Their brains gushed out all over, soaked the floor, and ripping them limb from limb to fix his meal, he bolted them down like a mountain lion, left no scrap, devoured entrails, flesh and bones, marrow, and all." After washing down the gruesome meal with milk, the giant falls asleep. The next day, Polyphemus consumes two more of the Greeks for breakfast and another pair for supper. And although Odysseus feels that the jury is still out on his intimidation ploy, his men suggest that he come up with an alternate plan. Soon after, our hero talks the Cyclops into drinking some wine he and his men had brought, telling the giant that they'd intended to present it to him as a gift, before he started eating everybody, that is. After downing three bowlfuls, Polyphemus falls down drunk. As wine came spurting, flooding up from his gullet with chunks of human flesh. Presumably skirting bits of their partially digested crewmates, the vengeance-minded Greeks uncover an oar-sized piece of wood they had previously sharpened and buried under the sheep dung littering the cave floor. After heating the tip, Odysseus and four mates snap into battering ram mode, slamming the point home and poking out the snoozing Cyclops's favorite eye. The crafty Greeks avoid the enraged Polyphemus and also manage to make him look bad in front of his giant friends who have stopped by to investigate the ruckus. The following morning, after the Cyclops rolls away the stone to let out his flock, Odysseus and his men make their escape, hanging beneath the bodies of the giant's sheep. In Theogony, Homer's fellow poet Hesiod recounts the tale of Cronos, the father of the gods, who learns from his parents, heaven and earth, that his own son will one day overthrow him. To prevent this, Cronos eats his first four children, but the youngest, Zeus, is spared when the children's mother hands her husband a rock wrapped in swaddling clothes instead of baby Zeus. I interviewed classicist Mary Knight at her office in the American Museum of Natural History. The tale of Cronos suggests an early religious connection with the taboo on eating people, she said, since Zeus would not do to his offspring what his father tried to do to him. Echoing what Maggie Kilgore wrote about how eating can be used as a way to reinforce cultural differences, Knight continued, "The story may thus support cannibalism as a part of the ancient Greek view of a primitive past versus the civilized present. Greeks came to see themselves as different, calling all non-Greeks savages, people who may have continued eating people." Although Polyphemus and Cronos were fictional characters and not exactly card-carrying humans, which might upset cannibalism purists, this may not have been the case with some of the man-eaters described by another ancient Greek, Herodotus, circa 484 to 425 BCE. In his masterpiece, The Histories, the man often referred to as the father of history wrote that the Persian king Darius asked some Greeks what it would take for them to eat their dead fathers. "No price in the world," they cried, presumably in unison. Next, Darius summoned several Calatians, who lived in India and who eat their dead fathers. Darius asked them what price would make them burn their dead fathers upon a pyre, the preferred funerary method of the Greeks. "Don't mention such horrors," they shouted. Herodotus, writing as Darius, then demonstrated a degree of understanding that would have made modern anthropologists proud. "These are matters of settled custom," he wrote, before paraphrasing the lyric poet Pindar, and custom is king of all. In other words, society defines what is right and what is wrong. But while some of Herodotus's writings certainly reinforced the idea that culture is king, at the same time his tales also portrayed cannibalism as a sensational and utterly repugnant act, thus helping to propagate a mindset that cannibalism was bad behavior. As such, his combination of history and myth offers important clues about the spread of the cannibal taboo. Herodotus was also the first writer to document the practice of drawing lots during crises, with the person holding the short straw killed and eaten by his starving comrades. According to the historian, during King Cambyses' expedition to Ethiopia, his men ran out of provisions, and after slaughtering and consuming their pack animals, they were reduced to munching on grass. Herodotus describes how when they came to the desert, some of them did something dreadful. They cast lots with 1 out of 10 men killed and eaten by his comrades. After learning of this, Cambyses reportedly abandoned the campaign. The father of history also wrote extensively about the Scythians, horse-riding barbarian nomads living in the area north of the Black Sea. According to Herodotus, among their many strange customs, the Scythians enjoyed smoking marijuana and eating their enemies. Additionally, like Ed Gein, the model for the fictional characters Norman Bates and Buffalo Bill, The Silence of the Lambs, Scythian warriors also found some unique uses for human skin and body parts, using severed hands for arrow quivers and carrying around human skins stretched upon frames. In what may be Herodotus's most influential cannibal-related story, he recounted the tale of Astyages, the last king of the Median Empire. One night, the king awakens from a particularly bad nightmare in which his daughter Mandane made water so greatly that she filled all his city, eventually flooding all of Asia. Several years later, as Mandane is carrying her first child, the king has another bad dream. In this one, an enormous vine grows out of his daughter's privy parts until all of previously urine-soaked Asia falls under its mighty shade. The Magi are asked to interpret, and they attempt to put their king at ease by telling him that Mandane will give birth to a son, and that the boy will one day destroy Astyages' empire. Since there are apparently no pruning shears big enough for this gardening job, Astyages sends his favorite general, Harpagus, to find Mandane and kill her child. Harpagus, however, refuses to spill innocent blood and instead hands the newborn off to a herdsman and his wife. The latter, by coincidence, has just given birth to a stillborn son. Predictably, the quick-thinking general departs with the body of the dead child, which he delivers to the king. 10 years later, Mandani's son and his sheep-herding foster dad are granted an audience with King Astyages, who, while talking to the boy, recognizes the family resemblance. After some quick back calculations, the king realizes what his formerly favorite general has done. Astyages sends the boy off with servants, then questions the herdsman, who quickly fesses up to the entire ruse. Harpagus is summoned, and seeing the herdsman, he attempts to weasel out of the predicament, admitting that he felt bad about killing the boy. Harpagus then tells the king that he did what anyone in his predicament would have done. He ordered the herdsman to murder the infant. King Astyages, who may have also been famous for his poker face, then tells Harpagus something along the lines of, "Hey, no problem, I felt bad about asking you to kill my grandson anyway." The general presumably lets out a huge sigh of relief, but before he can get too relaxed, the king follows up. "Oh, and by the way," he adds, although once again probably not in those exact words, "why don't you and your son come to dinner tonight so we can all celebrate together?" Relieved, Harpagus returns home and instructs his son to head over to the banquet immediately. The boy responds with the ancient Persian equivalent of, "You got it, Dad," and leaves for the party. According to Herodotus, this is what happened next. When Harpagus's son came to Astyages, the king cut his throat and chopped him limb from limb, and some of him he roasted and some he stewed. When it was dinner hour and the other guests had come, then for those other guests and for Astyages himself there were set tables full of mutton. But before Harpagus the flesh of his own son, all save for the head and extremities of the hands and feet, these were kept separate, covered up in a basket. When the meal is done, Astyages asks the general how he liked the feast, and although Harpagus initially gives it the big thumbs up, the party ends on a sour note once the king has his general open the basket containing his son's uneaten body parts. If this story sounds familiar, that's because it has appeared in several versions since the time of Herodotus. Most notably, William Shakespeare co-opted it for the filial cannibalism scene in The Tragedy of Titus Andronicus. In the bard's most violent and arguably most maligned play, Titus, a Roman general, engages in an increasingly gory running battle with his archenemy, Tamora, the queen of the Goths. Late in the play, and after his daughter has been raped and mutilated by Tamora's two sons, Titus exacts his revenge. He kills the siblings and has their bodies baked in a pie, which he serves at a banquet to the queen and her husband, Saturninus. After Titus reveals his secret ingredient, everyone's plans for a quiet meal get tweaked a bit when Titus kills Tamora, Saturninus kills Titus, and Titus's son kills Saturninus. It is also possible that Shakespeare may have gotten his cannibal inspiration from Seneca's first-century Roman tragedy, Thyestes, in which the title character not only tricks his twin brother Atreus out of the throne of Mycenae, but also takes his sister-in-law as a lover. Thyestes continues his bad behavior by chiding Atreus that he can have the throne back as soon as the sun moves backward in the sky. Zeus, however, overhears the taunt and drives the day back against its dawning. Before you can say banished, Thyestes is forced to surrender the throne. Atreus, though, isn't done with his slimy sibling, and after learning of his wife's infidelity, he invites Thyestes to a reconciliatory banquet. As part of the party prep, Atreus murders Thyestes' two sons from the forbidden relationship and serves them to their unsuspecting dad, who has obviously not been keeping up with his readings of Herodotus. At dinner's end, Atreus presents Thyestes with the hands and heads of his slain children on a platter, forever defining the term Thyestean feast as one at which human flesh is served. In short, from the ancient Greeks to William Shakespeare, and in stories written across a span of 2,500 years, cannibalism was depicted as either the ultimate act of revenge or the gruesome work of gods, monsters, and savages, aka non-Christians and anyone living in the vicinity of some gold. By the 17th and 18th centuries, with the taboo firmly established, the threat of cannibalism would reach a new audience and serve a new purpose as a way to terrorize children into behaving. Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm, born in 1785 and 1786 respectively, were German academics who collected oral folk tales during the early 1800s. They did so by interviewing peasants, servants, middle-class types, and aristocrats, and they published hundreds of fairy tales in the years between 1812 and 1818. In the parade of new editions that followed, the brothers changed, added, and subtracted stories, depending on how well they had been received previously. Like the ancient Greek and Roman myths, the original fairy tales depicted violence, desire, heartbreak, and fear. They also portrayed the all-too-common hardships of their own time, especially famine and the abandonment of children by destitute parents. The language was often scatological and, as such, many of the updates the authors initiated reflected the fact that the originals were definitely not kid-friendly. As the Grimms sanitized these tales for publication and for a much younger readership, themes were also modified. But rather than molding them into the bedtime stories familiar to modern readers, the brothers transformed them into cautionary tales, many of which ended badly for children who chose not to obey their parents. On one level, at least, fairy tales can be seen as literary relics from a time when terror was an accepted educational tool. Bearing almost no resemblance to the politically correct stories written today for kids, the original Grimm's fairy tales were tools employed by parents to socialize children, to increase their moral standing, and to frighten them into obeying the directives of their elders. The Grimm brothers were preceded as writers by Charles Perrault, 1628-1703, a Frenchman whose 1697 Histoire du Conte de Temps Passé provided readers with what may have been the earliest written collection of fairy tales. His most famous book, subtitled Les Contes de ma mère Loi, Tales of Mother Goose, contained 8 stories, including Red Riding Hood, Sleeping Beauty, and Puss in Boots, and its reception by the public elevated the fairy tale into a new literary genre. As it would be with the Grimm stories, Perrault's fairy tales often contained a heavy dose of cannibalism. For example, most children and adults will recall that the Wicked Queen in Snow White wanted the title character killed. Less familiar, perhaps, is that in the original tale, the Queen not only orders a huntsman to murder Snow White, but to return with her liver and lungs as proof that the deed had been done. Taking pity on the innocent beauty, Harpagus style, the hunter slays a boar instead and brings the Queen a Snow White-sized portion of porcine organ meat. Then, in a scene that somehow wound up on the cutting room floor at the Disney studios, the misled monarch cooks up the offal in a stew, which she eats, thinking perhaps that except for an unfortunate gravy stain, she has seen the last of Snow White. An equally disturbing revelation is found in the source material for the Perrault fairy tale Little Red Riding Hood. Unaltered from Perrault's story is the setup in which the wolf gets to Granny's house before Red. But in the original story, a French peasant tale that may date from the 10th century, as translated by Paul Larue and reported by fairy tale scholar Jack Zipes, instead of gobbling down the old woman whole so that she can later emerge, Jonah-like, from the wolf's bisected belly, the werewolf murders the old woman and cuts her up, storing pieces of granny meat in the cupboard along with a bottle of her blood. When Red Riding Hood arrives, the creature directs her to the cabinet, saying, "Take some of the meat which is inside and the bottle of wine on the shelf." After unknowingly eating her own grandmother and drinking her blood, Red strips and the wolf tosses her clothes into the fire. "You won't be needing those anymore," he tells her. She then gets into bed with the hirsute granny, and after a famous bit of dialogue, Red escapes after convincing the creature that she needs to go outside for a pee. I'm not making this up. In Perrault's Hop o' My Thumb, 7 young brothers, led by Little Thumb, the smallest but smartest sibling, are abandoned in the forest by their destitute parents in a time of great famine. A kindly woman, who turns out to be the wife of a cruel ogre who eats little children, eventually takes in the lost kiddies. In the nick of time, she hides them under a bed as her giant husband returns. Luckily, he knocks before entering his own house. But soon he smells fresh meat and drags the children out from their hiding place. Even as the kids fall to their knees begging for mercy, the ogre is already devouring them in his mind, especially since they would be delicate eating when my wife made a good sauce. The story ends badly for the ogre who, thanks to Little Thumb, slits the throats of his own 7 daughters by mistake. Adding to the ogre's misery, Little Thumb not only manages to steal the ogre's magic boots, but also cheats Mrs. Ogre out of all their money. The tiny lad then returns home, where he was received with an abundance of joy from his father, who quickly realizes that he can probably retire from a career spent tying together bundles of twigs. One moral of this story is that you should not knife anyone in a darkened room where your kids are sleeping. Another appears to be that child-eating cannibals will not live happily ever after. The Brothers Grimm revisited a similar plot in Hansel and Gretel, which also detailed the abandonment of the young and the threat of cannibalism. The story begins with a concise and vivid portrayal of famine. Great scarcity fell on the land. But in the Grimm's tale, rather than an ogre's wife, a kindly old woman takes in the lost brother and sister. The hag, however, quickly reveals both her true witchy identity and her intentions after she locks Hansel in the stable. "When he is fat, I will eat him," she cackles, and later, Let Hansel be fat or lean tomorrow. I will kill him and cook him. Other fairy tale writers also employed the cannibalism angle, most notably Englishman Benjamin Tabart, 1767 to 1833, in his 1807 story, The History of Jack and the Beanstalk. According to Maria Tatar, a leading authority on children's literature, Tabart, like Perrault in The Brothers Grimm, based his tale on older tellings of the story. Although Jack existed in many versions, it is Tabart's that would become the model for subsequent adaptations, notably that of Joseph Jacobs, who compiled and edited 5 popular books of fairy tales in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In Tabart's story, Jack is indolent, careless, and extravagant, and his actions bring his mother to beggary and ruin. Trading in the family's milk cow to a stranger for a handful of seeds seems like a typical move for this lame incarnation of Jack. But of course things get interesting when his mother tosses the seeds away and an enormous beanstalk shoots up in hyper-bamboo fashion just outside their cottage. Climbing the ladder-like super-stem, Jack meets a curiously tall woman and asks her for some breakfast. "It's breakfast you'll be if you don't move off from here," she tells him. "My man is an ogre, and there's nothing he likes better than boiled boys on toast." But Jack is starving, and, ignoring the danger, he convinces the wife to bring him back to her place for a bite. Soon enough, though, the ground is rumbling, and Jack barely has time to jump into the oven before the big guy bursts in, reciting the most famous lines in all of ogredom. "Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll have his bones to grind my bread." Unimpressed, his wife tells him that he's probably dreaming. "Or perhaps you smell scraps of the little boy you liked so much for yesterday's dinner." Satisfied, the ogre has his breakfast before settling down for a nap. Jack, showing just how thankful he is to have been spared by the ogress, promptly steals not only the couple's gold and a harp that plays itself, but because you can never have enough gold, he filches a goose that lays golden eggs. Next, after somehow hauling all of this loot down to the ground, Jack shows off his logging skills by cutting down the beanstalk just in time to send the ogre plummeting to his death. In Joseph Jacobs's revised epilogue, a good fairy shows up and informs everyone that the giant had actually stolen the gold from Jack's late father. With the theft and killing justified, Jack and his mother became very rich, and he married a great princess, and they lived happily ever after. In story after story, the Grimms, Perrault, and other fairy tale writers piled on scenes of cannibalism, or at the very least its threat. In Cannibalism and the Colonial World, Marina Warner describes these collections as the foundation stones of nursery literature in the West. As such, these stories serve to reinforce the idea, for readers of all ages, that cannibalism was the stuff of nightmares and naughty children. Beyond the historians, playwrights, poets, and compilers of fairy tales, there were others who contributed to what became our culturally ingrained ideas about cannibalism. 3 of the most influential were the writer Daniel Defoe, Scottish anthropologist Sir James George Frazer, and the father of psychoanalysis Sigmund Freud. Daniel Defoe, circa 1660 to 1731, was a prolific author and perhaps the founding father of the English novel. Born in London as Daniel Foe, he eventually changed his name in an effort to construct an aristocratic origin from what had actually been a lower-class upbringing. It was a childhood during which young Daniel survived not only London's Great Plague in 1665, but also its Great Fire the following year. After abandoning an up-and-down career as a businessman, Defoe began writing books, pamphlets, and poems, many of them with a political bent. Robinson Crusoe, published in 1719, was his most famous work, and by the end of the 19th century it had become a worldwide phenomenon. Running through nearly 200 editions and translated into 110 languages, Robinson Crusoe has been abridged, pirated, spun off, and turned into an array of children's books, an opera, and several movies. The plot of Robinson Crusoe follows the decades-long adventures of the shipwrecked title character as he struggles to survive on a tropical island, possibly based on the island of Tobago. After establishing a relatively comfortable life for himself, Crusoe knows that the most serious threat to his safety comes from the man-eating savages who frequent the island. These wretches, the reader is informed, battled each other in canoes, with the victors killing and eating their prisoners Carib-style. This grim predilection for murder and the consumption of human flesh is spelled out in sensational detail when the castaway comes upon the remains of a cannibal feast on the beach. I was perfectly confounded and amazed. Nor is it possible for me to express the horror of my mind at seeing the shore spread with skulls, hands, feet, and other bones of human bodies, and particularly I observed a place where there had been a fire made, and a circle dug in the earth, where I supposed the savage wretches had sat down to their human feastings upon the bodies of their fellow creatures. After spewing his lunch, the suitable response of any civilized Englishman, Crusoe hurries back to his side of the island and his castle, where for the next 2 years he fixates about the wretched, inhuman custom of their devouring and eating one another up. Crusoe fantasizes gruesome plans for revenge, including one in which he sets off explosives under the cannibal cooking pit, and another in which he blows off their heads from a sniper's nest. While brooding over his own obsession, Crusoe begins to doubt whether the savages actually knew that they were committing horrendous crimes. In a rare instance of 18th-century clarity regarding Columbus and those who followed him, Crusoe wonders whether killing the cannibals would justify the conduct of the Spaniards and all their barbarities practiced in America, where they destroyed millions of these people. Initially, the fictional castaway decides to steer clear of the savages, but he winds up killing one of them while rescuing Friday, a cooking pot escapee, who is himself a cannibal. Once the main party of man-eaters departs, Crusoe and Friday return to the scene of the cannibal feast. The place was covered with human bones. The ground dyed with their blood, and great pieces of flesh left here and there, half-eaten, mangled, and scorched. All the tokens of the triumphant feast they had been making there after a victory over their enemies. After piling up the body parts and setting them ablaze, Crusoe observes that Friday still had a hankering stomach after some of the flesh, and he lets the savage know in no uncertain terms that death awaits should he give in to his cravings. Friday quickly gets his own point across, presumably using a combination of miming and interpretive dance, that he would never eat man's flesh anymore. Years later, Crusoe and Friday come upon another cannibal banquet, and this time the next course appears to be bearded white guy. At this point, all of Crusoe's previously developed ideas about non-involvement in local customs are put to the test. But after downing a few shots of rum, the castaway and his lethal sidekick, now a good Christian, wade in and let fly in the name of God, slaughtering 17 or 18 of the 21 man-eaters with guns, swords, and a hatchet. Robinson Crusoe had a major impact on readers all over the world. According to University of Sorbonne professor of literature, Frank Lestringon, Defoe's work is an effective contribution to the black legend of the cannibals. It represents the normal English attitude towards them throughout the ages of discovery and colonization. In short, cannibalism was an abomination, and cannibals were to be avoided, since God would ultimately sort out their fate. But if that didn't work, anyone who practiced man-eating could be enslaved or killed by any method, no matter how cruel or gruesome it might appear. In 1890, Sir James Fraser, 1854 to 1941, produced The Golden Bough, A Study in Magic and Religion, a massive globe-spanning comparative work on mythology and religion. Much of this material was accompanied by a hefty dose of archaeological support, and Fraser's enormously popular compendium of rites, practices, and religions greatly influenced the emerging discipline of anthropology. Throughout his magnum opus, Fraser discussed the practice of cannibalism and other barbarous customs. He also advised his readers not to be fooled into judging the savage by the standard of European civilization. Fraser pointed to several African tribes whose religious rites included the custom of tearing in pieces the bodies of animals and of men, and then devouring them raw. Thus the flesh and blood of dead men are commonly eaten and drunk to inspire bravery, wisdom, or other qualities for which the men themselves were remarkable. According to Fraser, this type of cannibalism also took place among the mountain tribes of southeastern Africa, the Thedora and Garigo tribes of southeastern Australia, the Kamilaroi of New South Wales, the Dayaks of Sarawak, the Tlalki of central Celebes, the Italones and Efigao of the Philippine Islands, the Kai of German New Guinea, the Kimbunda of western Africa, and the Zulus of southern Africa. During the first half of the 20th century, the Golden Bough influenced an array of major authors, including Joseph Campbell, T.S. Eliot, Robert Graves, James Joyce, D.H. Lawrence, Ezra Pound, and William Butler Yeats. As previously mentioned, Fraser's work also became an enormously popular resource for the budding anthropologists who were beginning to trek into some of the most remote regions on the planet. Although each subsequent generation found flaws in Fraser's work or had to modify certain aspects of it, there is little doubt that his stance on the prevalence of cannibalism among indigenous people colored the mindset of many a fresh-faced anthropologist. As a result, when such groups were encountered, they were assumed to be savages whose behavioral repertoire would likely encompass all manner of strange rites, including cannibalism. Contributing to this attitude was perhaps the most well-known of these new anthropologists, Margaret Mead, 1901 to 1978, who was famously quoted about some of the Pacific Islanders she was studying. "The natives are superficially agreeable, but they go in for cannibalism, headhunting, infanticide, incest, avoidance and joking relationships, and biting lice in half with their teeth." Anthropologists were not the only professionals talking about cannibalism and the primitive mind. For Sigmund Freud, the behavior denoted a pre-cultural stage of human development. In his appropriately named 1913 book, Totem and Taboo, Freud borrowed Darwin's concept of a patriarchal horde, where a single mature male ruled over a harem of females. Immature males, the brothers, who were forbidden to mate, also belonged to this primitive social group. Freud assumed that these fellows would be quite grumpy, and as such he proposed that they were hot to initiate some revision of the prehistoric status quo. They did so by killing their father, thus putting an end to the patriarchal horde. Cannibal savages as they were, it goes without saying that they devoured their victim as well as killing him, each of the sons acquiring a measure of their father's strength. In order to commemorate the event, the brothers organized a totem feast, which Freud described as mankind's earliest festival. This, though, was no ordinary party, since, according to Freud, it marked the beginning of social organization, moral restrictions, and religion. Once cannibalism and its partner incest were abandoned, the group in question would be firmly on the road to civilization, a mindset that is highly reminiscent of the one espoused by explorers, missionaries, and early anthropologists as they encountered indigenous cultures. As Stony Brook University anthropologist Bill Ahrens wrote in 1979, "What could be more distinctive than creating a boundary between those who do and those who do not eat human flesh?" Freud also went on to say that taboos, like cannibalism, represent forbidden actions for which there exist strong and unconscious predispositions, primitive urges buried deep within each of us. From a zoological perspective, these primitive urges can be seen as further evidence that we humans are, to paraphrase Stephen Jay Gould, a part of nature, not apart from nature, and as such, we still retain bits of an ancient genetic blueprint. We are also, however, of a lineage that has diverged greatly during our long evolution. and the more recently added or modified sections of our genetic code have seen us evolve away from the behavior of spiders, mantises, and fish, though less so from our fellow mammals. Part of that divergence is that humans are cultural creatures, and for some of us the very underpinnings of our Western culture, starting with our literature, dictate that unless we are placed into extreme circumstances, certain practices, like cannibalism, are forbidden. But what about cultures in which those Western taboos were never established? Would they enact similar prohibitions on such behavior?